From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect Weekend. I'm Mitch Tite.
And I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, the importance of sunshine laws in allowing citizens to analyze how their governments work.
The Wisconsin Public Record Law, in the very first paragraph, says that the law shall be construed in every instance with a presumption of complete public access. The denial of public access generally is contrary to the public interest, and only in exceptional cases may access be denied.
Then, how a play on stage at Milwaukee Chamber Theater is emblematic of a wider, new appreciation of the Black experience in America.
I love that Milwaukee is embracing this play so much. I would love to see more. There's still more to be done, a lot more.
Plus, we'll have the latest edition of our storytelling series, Ex Fabula. Lake Effect Weekend is next, after the news. Good afternoon. This is Lake Effect Weekend on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tike. This past week was Sunshine Week, and that is not a look at the weather. The annual event is an effort led by news organizations that seeks to inform people about their right to access public information. It is a right that's had many enemies, both historically and recently, but is also a right that has endured many tests.
As a young journalist in Madison, David Pritchard found himself testing the strength of this right. Pritchard is now a journalism professor at UW-Milwaukee, but in the 1970s, he was on the opposing side of the university system, where he sued UW-Madison for access to public records.
Decades later, Pritchard set out to see just how common his story has been. He and co-author John Anderson, who is also the winner of a similar lawsuit, analyzed every public records lawsuit filed against the University of Wisconsin system during the last four decades. They were surprised to find that in the last 40 years, the UW system has not won a single case in which it sought to conceal these records.
Pritchard sat down with Lake Effect's Joy Powers and started by describing how he and Anderson went about gathering the information.
One of the problems is that there's no list of all these lawsuits. So from a combination of personal knowledge, news coverage, talking to a lot of lawyers, including the lawyers at the Wisconsin Department of Justice who represent the university when the university is sued, we compiled what we think is a complete list. And then because the records in the trial courts are not online, we had to go from county courthouse to county courthouse to actually go through the paper files to understand what happened.
What is generally the university's position when it comes to these requests? Does it change a lot? I'm looking at your face.
I think it's variable. Yeah. I think sometimes the university doesn't have a problem when things come out, like if they're trying to get rid of somebody and they have a disciplinary report on that person and a news organization makes a request, the university is all too happy to let it out. However, when the university thinks that a news organization is snooping around for something that might put the university in a bad light, then the university is much more resistant.
Can you give me some examples of cases where the university has resisted giving out this information?
Well, the lawsuit I was involved in hundreds of years – actually was in the late 1970s when I was a very young reporter in Madison covering the university for a newspaper. I became interested in corporate funding of research and professors doing consulting for corporations. And I was aware because I read the list of grants given to the university that there were pesticide companies funding research on the safety of pesticides being done by professors in the agriculture school. Welch's Grape Juice Company was funding research on the effectiveness of vitamin C in preventing colds. And the Playboy Foundation was funding research into the effects of pornography. And I could go on and on. So I asked for records of faculty outside activities, basically faculty consulting activities, consulting for corporations, that all faculty members who did consulting were required to file. And the university resisted that. Madison campus resisted, saying that this would be a chilling effect on it, on research and teaching, and it would violate academic freedom, and it was the equivalent of McCarthyism, the chancellor told the faculty senate when he was reporting to the faculty senate about this. Well, the judge disagreed We got the records. There were no big conflict of interest bombshells in the records. The big finding was that 97% of the faculty members at the Madison campus didn't file any reports. And we knew that lots more than 3% of the Madison faculty had outside interests. And the court decision led to a new UW system code of ethics that requires all faculty members to file statements of their outside interests, if any, every year. I just filled out mine yesterday.
Oh.
I frankly don't know why the Madison campus resisted that. My co-author, John Anderson, was involved in an even more bizarre example. When he was editor of the UWM Post as an undergraduate here in Milwaukee, he asked the university for some records, really boring records, meeting agendas, minutes of meetings, audio recordings of meetings of the Union Policy Board, which had 6 students and 3 staff members on it. And UW-Milwaukee said no. Actually, they said yes, but they blacked out all the student names and they edited out all of the student audio from the audio tape because of the Family Educational Rights and Privacy Act. Even revealing the names of students who attended a public meeting, who were part of a decision-making body that attended a public meeting, the university said had to be kept secret. Well, this is a perversion of the intent of the Federal Educational Rights and Privacy Act. And so John filed a lawsuit in Milwaukee County Circuit Court right here. And the State Department of Justice, which is supposed to defend state agencies like the university, took one look at it and said, give them the records. You know, don't black anything out. This was a public meeting. This is ludicrous. And so the university turned over the records. But the university also had to pay more than $11,000 in legal fees, because that's one of the nice things about the Wisconsin public records law. If you make a request and the public agency says no and you go to court to get the records and you win, your legal fees get paid.
And you found in your analysis that every time a reporter or an organization questioned the withholding of information, that they won.
Yeah, that's really an interesting finding, because a little more than half of our cases involved news media requests for information. And by cases, I mean disputes where either the university didn't want to release the information or the university did want to release information about an employee, but the employee went to court to block release of the information. And the news media always won. They always got everything they wanted, sometimes via an out-of-court settlement with peripheral information redacted, like student addresses or social security numbers or things like that. But they always got the information they wanted. Interestingly, as the financial situation of the legacy news media has weakened in recent years, partisan advocacy groups have been making more and more requests, advocacy groups on the right and advocacy groups on the left. And they always win too. They always win. And so these groups that have kind of a public interest component, the news media and these advocacy groups, they have never lost, actually. So I don't even know why the university would bother going to court in some of these cases, frankly.
I know you analyzed these cases. Did you analyze how much money has been lost as a result of them?
That's really hard to calculate. The records are not complete on the out-of-court settlements. We didn't go campus by campus by campus to find out how much money has been paid out in the requester's legal fees. And of course, the lawyers are on salary, so it's very hard to account for how many hours of their time were spent on these on futile resistance to public records requests.
Well, and as you've said, it is kind of futile resistance. And the rationale has changed from the university, from the case that you cited in the 70s. How has the rationale for resisting giving this information, how has that evolved?
When I made my request in the late 70s, the resistance was on the basis of academic freedom. And there's this famous plaque bolted to the east wall of Bascom Hall on the Madison campus. And it's on a lot of other campuses too, including Milwaukee. And it talks about how the university is dedicated to the sifting and winnowing is the phrase, the sifting and winnowing by which alone truth can be found. Well, that's academic freedom. And we have to let faculty members and other scholars follow their muse wherever it goes in teaching and research. I'm a really strong advocate of academic freedom. The notion of academic freedom has changed, however. In the last 10 years, when the university replies to requests and resists requests, they often now talk about the university's commercial interests or the professor's commercial interests. In biomedical research, for example, there are patentable inventions, drugs and other kinds of things. And the royalties from those patents get funded back into the research mission of the university. And this can be millions and millions and millions of dollars. So that's a legitimate commercial interest. And if the information is made available via a public records request before a patent application is filed, then the patent application is muddied. Somebody else could steal it. So it seems odd to me to define academic freedom in terms of commercial interests. I think that's much more like trade secrets, which the Wisconsin public records law does allow to be withheld. You don't have to reveal trade secrets. But this kind of drift in the definition of academic freedom is certainly something we found.
What are some of the more egregious examples where people both working for the university and the university itself have sought to keep this information secret that really legally should be released?
First of all, let me say, I think the university feels under siege sometimes. The Madison campus has said that it spends more than $100,000 a year replying to public records requests, largely about animal research. So that's a burden on a university in a state where funding for public universities is going down instead of up. And I think we all need to acknowledge that these burdens are kind of irksome at times. That said, the Wisconsin public record law in the very first paragraph says that the law shall be construed in every instance with a presumption of complete public access. The denial of public access generally is contrary to the public interest, and only in exceptional cases may access be denied. Well, the University of Wisconsin system is one of the biggest state agencies. We often forget that the University of Wisconsin system is part of state government. And so the university has an obligation to be accountable to the public, to be accountable to legislators. What have they tried to keep secret that came out? Where do I begin?
It's a big question.
Some of the more interesting cases came when the university or a university campus was willing to release information, but the employee went to court to block release of the information. And the public records law does allow employees in certain circumstances to try to block information. It never works, but employees try sometimes. There was a professor at UW-Stevens Point who slugged one of her students in the face. And there was a disciplinary report. The media heard about it. They sought access to the disciplinary report. The university was all too glad to release this, perhaps because they wanted to see the professor depart. And in an out-of-court settlement, the professor resigned and the report was released. Also at Stevens Point, there was a professor who was having consensual sexual affairs with two of his students, one of whom was an undergrad. People complained. There was a disciplinary report that documented the relationships and a lot of other, I guess, unhealthy sexual climate. One of the more interesting things, apparently this professor snuck into the undergraduate student's dorm room so that they could spend some time together there, those kinds of things. There was a professor up at UW-Superior I'm sorry to say, a journalism professor like me. But not like me in so many other ways, because he took a group of undergraduates to New York. He had made the travel arrangements. And it turned out that they were one hotel room short. So he invited an undergraduate to stay in his hotel room. And I'll spare you all the salacious details of what came out in the disciplinary report after she freaked out, called her parents, contacted police, etc. But that professor went to court to block access to that report. And of course, the report came out and the professor was fired.
So we're talking about this in light of Sunshine Week, which really deals with transparency. What does transparency in the UW system look like compared to other universities, other state universities?
We don't know. We don't really know because the study that John Anderson and I did is really the first study that looks at what happens in the trial courts with respect to public records laws and public university systems. But Sunshine Week is actually really important because it's not just the university and it's not just the state government. It's your local public school board. It's your village board. It's your city council. It's your town board if you live in a rural area. And it's really important for citizens of Wisconsin to understand that they have a right to attend the meetings of public bodies. They have a right of access to most public documents. And if you care about your government, why things happen the way they happen, you can learn an awful lot about these things. Now, sometimes your local municipal officials don't know about the law, or they might not want to share information. Sometimes they think that they have a certain proprietary interest in the information, but they don't. The law says that most records, not all records, but most records need to be disclosed. And there are some exceptions to the law. Certain kinds of personnel records don't have to be disclosed, but certainly people's job descriptions do, their salaries do. Any completed reports of disciplinary investigations need to be disclosed upon request. Transparency Week reminds us all that we are all a part of our government. And certainly the university is a government function. State government is government, but it's also your local government. Former Speaker of the U.S. House, Tip O'Neill, once said, "All politics is local." And in the little municipality I live in, people get passionate about local politics. And there's a window into that. It's called public records, open meetings. Take advantage of it.
Thank you so much for coming in and speaking with me today. And thank you so much for the work.
Thank you.
David Pritchard is a journalism professor at UW-Milwaukee and one of the authors of a study analyzing how the University of Wisconsin system handles transparency laws.
The full report will be published later this year by the Journal of College and University Law. There is more on that report and on Sunshine Week at WUWM.com.
A short break now, and then we meet the cast and director of The Brothers' Size, a fierce and lyrical play on stage at the Broadway Theater Center through this weekend. That's when Lake Effect Weekend continues on 89.7 WUWM.
Lake Effect Weekend continues now. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. The Milwaukee Chamber Theater production of Terrell Alvin McCraney's play, The Brothers' Size, tells the story of two brothers trying hard to find or cling to their paths in life. Rich with Yoruba imagery and driven by both rhythmic dialogue and a one-man orchestra of percussion instruments, the play is a lyrical and poetic exploration of what it means to be a brother.
I had an opportunity to sit down with Travis Knight and Andrew Mwange, who play the brothers Ogun and Oshusi Size, along with the percussionist Yames Finlayson and director Marty Goebel, to find out more about the production.
I want to start with the music, because I know music is such a key part of this play. The rhythm, I mean, you when you read the play, the lines are so rhythmic. Everything is so, it's almost contrapuntal, you know, when you look at it, almost like a piece of music. So what are you performing? You're kind of a one-man band over here.
Yes, and the production actually starts with music. I come on stage and I kind of set up my altar and all the instruments, and then I call the ancestors and I call the gods and call the characters to the stage. I am playing primarily percussion, and we've created a musical pit that's comprised of found objects, barrels, buckets, cans and such, and as well as some instruments that I've brought with me. Some of them are also made from repurposed materials.
You've got pan pipes there. Could you give us a little taste?
Sure.
Sometimes the bamboo doesn't agree.
Doesn't agree.
So now, Travis and Andrew, if you ever hear panpipes again, are you going to be immediately brought back to this play?
Yeah, I'm going to turn around and look and see if Yamas is behind me. Uh-huh.
So for you two, you're playing the brothers. When you first read this play and you looked at those parts, what did you think?
I was struck by how beautiful the language is. As you talked about, that script is great. And the way that Terrell writes, it's so lyrical and it's so poetic and it's beautiful. And then in the heart of it all, it's also a story about siblings. And I am the older brother. I have two siblings. I have a younger brother and a younger sister. So that's one thing that I pulled out the most is, like, Ogun is looking out and has always looked out for his younger brother. And I found that to be incredibly relatable. And then because I found that incredibly relatable, I knew how to infuse the rest of this script. And then I was like looking forward to coming to rehearsal the first time and meeting everybody and working with everybody and seeing what they were bringing to the table. And I knew that that was going to be something that audiences could really relate to, no matter where you come from. If you have a sibling or a family member who you love dearly, this is kind of the play for you. And that's what I was drawn to the most by that script.
Yeah, there is that taking care of, and then in your case, Andrew, resenting being taken care of. Mm-hmm.
I am the youngest in my family. I don't have a brother, but I have two older sisters. So I related to my character in that way. I knew it was going to be interesting just because of the way the play is structured. It wasn't like anything I've ever done before. Like, we were speaking stage directions, there's music. It was just a brand new thing to me.
Yeah, there was a lot of, like, reading the script, because one of the things that people keep asking who have seen the show, it's like, so I want to read this. Like, is it in the stage? It's like, no, that play comes bare bones. It comes with just the words. There's no stage directions in it. There's nothing to kind of tell you what these scenes are supposed to look like. So sometimes it's just a bunch of what looks like random, like, huzz and this road is rough and things like that, that you're like, how are we going to make this a story? So I was very curious how we were going to do that. But I knew that Marty had a bunch of things up her sleeve.
I did.
Well, and that is a perfect segue to you. What drew you to the play?
I was given the brother-sister plays a complete trilogy probably 5 years ago with, you know, an eye towards actually performing in the Red and Brown Water as Oya. And then intended to do, with my former company Uprooted, Travis and I's former company Uprooted, intended to do an entire season just focusing on the trilogy, and it was just too expensive to do. So when the opportunity came around again to direct in the Red and Brown Water with the collaboration with Marquette and Uprooted, I jumped on it, and that was fantastic. So I got to sink my teeth into it. And then we did that same season do a reading of The Brother's Sighs, which Michael Wright came to see and asked if I would be interested in directing it under Chambers' umbrella. And I said, absolutely. At this point, we knew that Uprooted was going to be closing its doors at the end of that particular season. I have a really great imagination, and I knew that I could do a lot with this if I had a room of collaborators. So, you know, the character of the Agungun is not included in this play, but I couldn't see how the ancestors wouldn't be called without a musician. I am fond of drumming and live music on stage, and so that is something that all of us in the room, of course with Yames doing the work of it, I knew that music had to be a part of it. And then my brother-in-law came in and helped with the step coordination and the choreography. I'm not a dancer, but I know what beautiful movement looks like. So it really was just a whole bunch of people with great ideas who loved a fantastic script.
Yeah, talk about this playwright. I mean, he is so powerful. It's so evocative. And the language is so raw and wonderful and yet elevated at the same time. It's like somehow he balances all of that.
Well, again, I've had the plays for some time, and I was really struck with the notion that you could let people know what they were looking at based on you speaking to them, what you were feeling or what you were doing. And I wonder how much confusion in life would be avoided if we could just know what we were looking at. You know, we misinterpret human physical and facial cues so many times. So that was a fantastic instrument that he has figured out how to do. And I don't believe that anyone has done that before. It's also, his writing is evidence of his confidence in himself as a Black man in America and understanding where he came from. So that I think will cover all of his works, including the movie Moonlight, which is somebody just struggling to be solid in self, which Terrell obviously had to go through at some point in time, as we all do, but he sure landed in a solid spot.
Had you two known, or all three of you, known his work before?
I read the plays years ago. I own the trilogy. It's part of it's on my bookshelf. And I read it years and years ago, and I loved it, and I thought it was beautiful again, but it was that whole idea of how is this even? How do you stage this? What does it look like? Because I'd never seen it. And I hadn't been in Chicago because it was at Steppenwolf years ago. And that was before my time in Chicago. So I didn't get a chance to see it. But I remember hearing things about it. And so I've always been struck by it. I've always thought it was beautiful. And then, I saw Moonlight last year. And I was like, wow, okay.
Mm-hmm.
So this is what this could be.
Okay. There he is, mm-hmm. Yeah. And Andrew, for you?
I had seen Moonlight, but it's really, the language is way different. Just different structurally than this play. I had seen In the Red and Brown Water that Marty directed a couple of years ago. So when she asked me to be a part of this, I was like, okay. Yeah.
And as we said, the music is so much part. It's almost like it's the fourth character in this play, the way it's being described. Because, again, the structure of it is so musical and so rhythmic.
It is. And I'd agree. And sometimes I'm actually mirroring or echoing some of the language on the drums in some of the interludes that I play. This is my first exposure to his writing and his work. I did see Moonlight, but I didn't get into it on this level. And I've been struck, even as we go through the play, how the language, there's a circularity and a rhythm to it. So things that are spoken early on come back at different points in the plays, and there are things that I'm still learning. I'm there every night participating in the telling of this story, but there's new information that's coming up all the time, and some of it just really gives me goosebumps and pulls tears when I realize that he has, forespoken certain things that then come back and the language, it's really incredible. And it's kind of, it'll catch people off guard when they first are getting into it, when they first, are listening to people speak their stage directions and all, but it's really amazing.
Now, was this something you composed with the cast, or did you come in with ideas or musical motifs already?
I came as a blank slate and just and responded. And also, I'm a very intuitive musician anyway, so I listen to the energy in the room and to what's going on, and sometimes instruments will even give you nudges in certain directions. But sometimes I would play something and they're like, what did you do? It's like, that's not here, let's listen to the tape, because what you did then, let's set that, so it was a process.
So you've created a score.
True. Yeah, I mean, it does happen in the room. Yames and I worked together on The Ballad of Emmett Till. So he knew how I worked, which is I would say something, I need a scary swamp feel. And then he would take those words and interpret them into sound. But it does need to be said that the composition of this music happened in the room, mm-hmm. in the same way that the actors are composing and putting their characters together, mm-hmm. which again is a testament to Terrell's script. I love that it's so lean and he gives you no direction. And to me, that is deep trust in one's writing ability. Mm-hmm. To say, take it and dream with it.
Yeah. Do something different.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You get to be part of it.
Yes.
You get to be part of that creation. It's like it's slightly unfinished.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's, I mean, there's really, I don't know if you've read it, there's nothing. There's nothing in there. This is, I mean, has been an incredibly collaborative process. I can't say it any clearer than that. Mm-hmm. There's nothing. We took some thoughts and ideas and a spiritual tradition, and we just got together in a room with no egos. Very rarely does that happen in this profession. And unparalleled trust in what each of us could and would do.
Mm-hmm. Which I think, it, along with his writing, he writes in such a lean and theatrical style that some of this text is like, it's so heightened. It's like on the level with verse and classical text and things like that. So then to have to rise to the occasion to take this theatrical language and just infuse it with honesty and authenticity was a challenge, but also incredibly rewarding because we're constantly doing that. And every performance, we're still finding moments to like live in that truth and make it real and act as humans act, as Marty told us to do throughout the rehearsal
process. Be humans.
Be humans. Remember what that's like.
But also gods at the same time.
At the same time. Yes, because, oh, there's very much that part of it, too.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. The characters are all named after deities or orisha in the Yoruba spiritual tradition. So they are gods, and each of them, they're archetypes, and each of them have different energies, and that's also influenced, you know, some of the music as well.
Well, and I was thinking as I was reading it, because of that sort of human and deity all at the same time, it was very Greek.
Oh, yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You can tell he's done his reading.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, and
yes.
He's watched a lot of Greek plays.
It makes me want to tackle some of,
the
you know,
Aristotle,
oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
Aeschylus, all of these. I would love to just jump in there now. I'm like, oh, I got this.
Now,
I mean, I guess I already did,
yeah.
You know?
Do you think we're in a point in our cultural history where the black voices and the black experience is getting a new kind of respect and a new kind of listening? It feels like it with Peele winning, you know, the Oscar for screenplay.
Mm-hmm.
It feels like there's been a shift. And I don't know if that's me looking at it from the outside in, you know, as a white person looking at it going, oh, I think some things are changing. I mean, do you feel like they are?
I do. I think shift is definitely happening. I've had people come up to me after the show and say, oh, I've never seen anything like that before. I want to see more. So I think that the interest is definitely there and the voices are getting louder. It's like in this play, so you get to see black people not how you typically see them. You get to see the vulnerability. And I feel like when you usually see black people, it's like you see the masculinity. Like that's the focus. So it's nice to be portrayed in a slightly different light, show people a different side of people.
It's stereotypes. You all get into whatever that stereotype of the moment is, and it feels like here, at least in this particular play, you're getting to be fully human.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
It makes sense. I mean, it's.
Yeah.
I think we are at an age now that we've all known all along, if people would have just listened sooner, you know what I mean? It would have started sooner. But like, yeah, now we are at a point now where it is everywhere. We have this play that people aren't used to seeing. You've got Black Panther out there right now that it grossed. So like all these old tropes and notions that like, oh, well, black-led films and television shows can't make money and people aren't interested in that kind
it's
of
like
thing.
Women
it's,
can't do it. Mm-hmm.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
It is now being blown wide open and people are forced to listen because it's out there and the voices are louder now than they've ever been.
Well, and as we know, the second part of what you do is business, you know, for show business. And the fact that, like, Black Panther is hugely popular and hugely profitable is going to make a huge difference, I think.
Mm-hmm.
That's unfortunately, we have that economic piece that has to come in.
Mm-hmm.
But once it does, it's people go, oh, why didn't we see this before?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I still think there's a lot of growth to happen. You know, this is my constant soapbox. I love that Milwaukee is embracing this play so much and seeing the quality of a lot of things, the design elements, the actors, the the quality of the audience and their willingness to respond or to be still as they watch the plays, I would love to see more. There's still more. There's more to be done.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. A lot more.
I think the war's never won. No. You just have to keep fighting.
Oh yeah.
And you win little things here and there, but there's always you're always going to have to fight another day.
Oh yes.
Yeah.
Oh yes.
Yeah, there's never time or room to be complacent. Like it's just mm-hmm. something that we have to continually fight for and do. So yeah.
Right.
That's absolutely right.
Well, I want to thank all of you for, I know you have a performance coming up and you need to go prepare, but thanks so much for sitting and talking with me.
Thank you, Bonnie.
Thank you, Bonnie.
Marty Goble directed The Brothers' Size. Travis Knight and Andrew Mwange star as the brothers, and Yames Finlayson is the percussionist. The show plays through Sunday in the Studio Theater in the Broadway Theater Center in the Third Ward.
We will take one more break and then have our storytelling series, Ex Fabulo. Lake Effect Weekend returns right after this on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
3, 2, 1.
Welcome to Ex Fabulo!
True personal story.
Ex Fabulo!
Ex Fabula is a Milwaukee nonprofit committed to strengthening community bonds through the art of storytelling.
And for St. Patrick's Day weekend, it is Ex Fabula Radio on WUWM. I'm Bruce Winter. Leah Delaney is here, of course. She has no connection to anything Irish or St. Patrick's
Day. Nothing. Absolutely nothing at all.
With a name like that.
Don't forget the Colleen in the middle. Okay. Leah Colleen Delaney.
Oh, I love the way you say it like that. Well, this is your weekend.
It is, along with everybody else's in Milwaukee. And we all know that to be true because every St. Patrick's Day, we've seen Water Street go just straight to Crazy Town, USA. So we at Ex Fabula decided to, you know, culminate a couple of stories, you know, curate a couple stories here that involve with everything that you should not do on St. Patrick's Day in the event you needed a little reminder. We have two stories that are just chock full of awesome, great stuff that you just shouldn't do.
Yeah.
You know, I could probably actually start out this show.
Why don't you begin with your story?
Oh, why, thank you for asking. I was living in New York City, and me and my girlfriends were having a gas on the Lower East Side somewhere at some bars, and we were drinking some green beer and all that jazz. And I start chatting up this guy in a really bad acting 101 Irish brogue. Just exceptionally bad. But it's okay. I was feeling the spirit of say to so-and-so, and I was going to do it. And, you know, and I'm getting really into it, and I'm really liking this guy. And he's asking me questions, and I'm answering, and yada, yada. And then, like, about 20 minutes into it, he asks me, "So, where are you from?" And I just couldn't lie anymore. I just had to drop the accent. And I just said, "Milwaukee, Wisconsin." And he looked at me, took a beat, he grabbed his beer, and he jetted.
That was like, it, man.
I'm sure that just like started out the trajectory of my bad karma with dating for the next like 30,000 years. But yeah, so don't do that. Don't put out a fake Irish accent, okay? You'd be doing yourself no favor.
No favors at all.
Yes. So let's get into some more things you maybe should not do on St. Patrick's Day and just in general. We're going to start out today's show with Andrew Steeves. He told this originally at our Forbidden Fruit Story Slam back in 2017. Here's Andrew Steeves.
So my best friend Mark and I have been friends literally since birth. And when we were young, we'd always do these fun things together. We'd play video games. We would go to the pool together. And we went to the high school. Everything changed. We'd play video games, we'd go to the pool together, but we'd also see girls. And there was one girl in particular that Mark was crazy about. Her name was Helen, and she was nice. The three of us hung out all the time, but she liked basically everyone except him. It was like if we were like Harry, Ron, and Hermione, if Hermione slept with a ton of dudes. Which is fine. If I were Hermione, I would also sleep with a ton of dudes. So nothing wrong with that. But my friend Mark would pine over her. Just, he'd write these embarrassing poems, and he'd share them with me. And I'd have to be like, dude, come on. I'm your friend, but... And the three of us would hang out all the time. And so one day, my dad had this party at his house, and he said if I wanted to make some extra cash, I could, like, pass around drinks or whatever. This is high school. And I asked if I could do it with a friend, because that sounded pretty boring. And he said, yeah, if it's a girl, because symmetry. So I asked Hermione to do it. And it was a nice time. We passed the drinks around. We made snuck a couple of sips for ourselves. And finally, the night wore on. It was like 2, 3 o'clock in the morning. We're on the couch. Everyone else is gone. And here's the thing about forbidden fruit. It's really, really... It's like low-hanging fruit. It's just kind of there. And the next thing I know, we're making out on the couch. And just give me a quick clap if you were raised Catholic. Okay. So you guys know there's like a baseline of guilt at all times. And when we're doing something like that we should be guilty about, it's even worse. And so the whole makeout session, I was like the guiltiest makeout session of my life. I'm selling myself short. The guiltiest makeout session / trip to second base of my life. And, like, it was so bad. It just hurt me so bad in here. I had to, like, externalize it. And so I'd just be like, oh, this is so bad. And she thought I was maybe, like, dirty talking. She's like, yeah, this is so bad. And the next day, I had to call Mark and tell him. Like, this is my best friend since birth. We'd done everything together. I couldn't keep this from him. And so I called him up and I go, hey, that this happened. It's probably going to happen again. And he was as cool with it as he could be. He was upset and he was like, wait, I understand, man. I mean, she's hot. I know. And Hermione and I lasted a week because, well, it was high school and she was Hermione Granger. She has her pick. And things were never really the same between Mark and me. And things were never the same between Mark and Hermione. We all kind of grew up and drifted our separate ways. And so I guess the moral of the story is... yeah, it's easy to get that forbidden fruit, but not always worth it. Thank you.
And that was Andrew Steeves with his forbidden fruit story, a.k.a. don't do that on St. Patrick's Day story.
You know, he's right, though. The forbidden fruit is always the easiest to pick, it seems, you know.
Yeah, especially when they've had 5 beers and you have as well. So, again, let's steer clear of our friends, girlfriends, and boyfriends. Okay, Milwaukee?
Get that? Okay. You know, you told your little St. Patrick's Day story. Working here on Water Street.
Yes.
Within, you know, a block from a large Irish bar. When St. Patrick's Day falls on a weekday, I'd be showing up at work at 8:45 in the morning, and the line to get into this bar stretches all the way down the street because it's already at capacity.
Yes.
And by 10 o'clock, people are like fall down drunk on Water Street.
I know. We're just stepping around, stepping over a bunch of fake Irish people. See, the thing is that Irish people actually know how to drink and we can hold our own. There's a big difference there. So anybody who's standing up in St. Patrick's Day, they're
Irish. They're probably Irish.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, what do we have for story two?
Oh, story two. Yes, yes. And then we'll go into our upcoming events in a couple of minutes. But Richard Caron told this story at our first time Story Slam just in February. Actually, at the Lakefront Brewery. It's a chock list of things not to do. So let's listen to Richard's story.
So my story tonight about the first time that I got arrested. I was 20 years old, and I was with a group of friends, and we were kind of drunk, but we wanted to get really drunk. We were in River West, kind of on Lloyd and Booth. And I was driving, there were 6 of us in the car, and I took a turn a little too fast, and the back end of my station wagon fishtailed a little bit, and everybody was quiet for about 10 seconds, and then one of my friends, Chris, started going, "Rich, rich, rich, rich." And I don't know what came over me. By the way, I'm not proud of this story at all. I am ashamed of this story because everybody in the car, and as well as multiple other people, may have died that evening. It was not cool. Do not do this. I floored the car from Booth all the way to Albanese's, through River West, 60 miles an hour, across Center, like Locust, all the way up there, with them screaming in the back of the car the whole time. So then we drank a whole bunch and then kind of had a crazy ride back. And at about 3 in the morning, some guy was waving a gun in the neighborhood, so we got kind of freaked out and decided to go to IHOP on the other side, where one of my friends proceeded to take his member out, at which point the IHOP people called the police, which we were unaware of. So we wound up, we made the decision that it seemed logical at that point to go to Bradford Beach because the sun was coming up. And we decided to get naked and see who could run the fastest 100 yards in the sand at 6 in the morning, drunk and naked, grabbing our junk and at passing commuters going to work. And so we get back in the car, and I go up the hill by the water tower, and I go through a stop sign. And this car starts following me. It's a little pickup truck. And we drove past this house I used to live. I didn't like the owners. They were rich bastards. So I was beeping my horn and flipping them off. That's when I noticed this truck was following us. And I decided I'm going to lose this guy. So I was delivering pizzas for Calderone at the time, and I knew all of the alleys. And I just started racing down, wrong way down a one-way street and in alleys. And I lost the guy behind O'Reilly's, pulled out on North Avenue, heading back to River West, thinking we were scot-free. Except the guy was an undercover cop who had called in 6 pursuit vehicles, converged in front of Judge's Irish Pub with their guns drawn, and proceeded to take the new, this is a quote from one of the cops, a new age East Side weenie waggler, threw us in the paddy wagon and took us back to IHOP, where they incorrectly identified me as the one that had pulled his member out at the table and asked for more coffee. So we get thrown in the holding cell on Locust and Third, and sat there for a while. And even then, it didn't really sink in what had happened. We were like singing spirituals and clanging our cups on the, you know, like pretending that we were clanging our cups on the thing. And then they released both of my friends first, and I was there alone, and it sunk in for the first time that I am in jail. And They finally released me at 11 in the morning. I had to walk back to my car, which had 3 bent rims. And I drove it home, and I gave the keys to my father. And I said, "Do not give me these keys for a week." And I went to bed. And I said it was my first time being arrested, but I learned my lesson. It was my last time. Thank you.
And that was Richard Caron, who is alive enough and out of jail long enough to go to that story slam to tell his story.
You know, it's a checklist of things not to do. It's just like, no, you don't do this. No, you don't do that.
Right.
Oh, man. Richard.
No.
So what's coming up?
Well, we got another story slam. You might have heard me mention this a few times now, but in March we have two story slams. We had our first over at Sugar Maple earlier this month, and the next one is going to be on March 22nd at Garfield's 502, and the theme is TMI.
One thing I think perhaps we should remind people is the event that Sugar Maple was sold out.
Yeah, it was.
And this next one probably will be too, so if you want to go...
You know what? These story slams really ramp up, especially like at the turn of January. The one at Lakefront Brewery, which is a huge venue,
huge
also
place.
Sold out too.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you just can't take your chances. So I definitely recommend people to go to our website, which is exfabula.org, to go get your tickets in advance. You know, go see what story slams are coming up. Get your stories together. Workshops, membership programs. I mean, we got it all there. Story-related everything.
Everything you need. And
anything.
if you want to hear these stories again or share them with somebody else, they are at WUWM.com. And Leah and I are here every weekend during Lake Effect Weekend with more stories from Exfabula.
Exfabula is a regular feature on Lake Effect Weekend, and it wraps up yet another edition of the show. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Thank you so much for making us a part of your afternoon. Lake Effect Weekend airs every Saturday and Sunday from 3 to 4. It's here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Stay tuned now. All Things Considered comes your way next. It's 4 o'clock.